Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
President Obama has a new job plan. Italy and Spain are under the microscope. End of month and quarter rebalancing is happening. And our guest today talking specifically about the U.S. dollar and a few technical points, Corey Rosenbloom from Afraid to Trade. All this and much more on episode number 218 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, and thanks for joining me today. It is coming up on the end of June. We are at, where are we here? We're at June, all the way to June 26th. The end of the week, the 27th, is going to start a very busy week of economics when it comes to the U.S., and we're going to see an interesting potential test of some key technical points when it comes to the S&P 500 and, of course, all the other indices like the Dow and, moreover, the NASDAQ. The S&P is just teetering on a question mark whether or not that all-important 1250, and why it's important, it seems, is that we've made it important. We've broken through the 50. We've broken through a few times and bounced off the 200 daily moving average. And this 1250 line is kind of this line in the sand that technical traders look for to see if there's going to be a continued breakdown or if there will be support. Now, I'll tell you something. It's an important week because if the bullish and more positive traders are unsuccessful this week in particular, in holding that line, there could be some real trouble ahead. Because this week is the end of the month, the end of the quarter. Rebalancing goes in. There's a bit of a chase to make up some of the lost ground from what happened this quarter and particularly this month when it comes to all the different indices. You know, we flattened out the S&P for the year. The NASDAQ and the Russell have gone back and forth to positive and negative territory recently. Dow's hanging in there a bit, but it is a really concerning point because they're also coming on the beginning of earnings season where we're going to get, I guess the best way to say it, we're going to get the realization of whether or not companies are able to maintain the high level of earnings as they had expected to in the face of the Middle East conflict, European situation, as well as the disaster in Japan. So a lot of those things are going to be discussed. What I want to talk with Corey about today, Corey Rosenbloom, he's my favorite technical guy. I want to talk to him about what's going on with the dollar and how that really affects things right now. He's done a lot of work about the areas of important technical resistance and support and how that affects the rest of the market. So we'll get into that. But I wanted to start off with what I thought was, how do I say this politely, the most, the most ridiculous jobs plan and just a bonehead way of creating the next level of opportunity for our economy to pull out of this situation. You know, we've seen that initial claims have been riding along this plus over the 400,000 mark, and we've seen leading indicators, particularly the ECRI, really sloping down recently. Manufacturing has been tailing off. Companies are again talking about how they want to start letting people go because the human headcount, the overall expenses related to them need to be cut in order to keep their margins up and their earnings up. And the slowdown that we've seen around the world because of the high oil prices, which we'll talk about that too, maybe about what happened last week with oil. But I got to tell you, I want to go through this whole discussion that was had this week, just this weekend, as a matter of fact, by President Obama with regard to his plan to reinvigorate the U.S. and the economy by bringing jobs. Now, I want you to listen. This is a 2 or 3 minute discussion that I'm going to break into. And bear with the recording because this is direct from the White House, by the way. And you would think they could have used a couple of filters and a few things to blank out some of the static. But listening to the beginning, President Obama starts out with talking about how we're going to pull out of Afghanistan. Okay, great. But then he gets into this whole discussion of this. Well, you have to listen to this, and I'm going to cut in because I you're not going to believe this.
Hello, everybody. Earlier this week, I spoke about our way forward in Afghanistan. And I said that because of the extraordinary work of our men and women in uniform, civilians, and our coalition partners, we will soon begin bringing our troops home, just as we've begun doing in Iraq. After a decade of conflict, we're finally bringing these wars to a responsible end. That's in the best interest of America's security. And it's also in the best interest of America's economy.
All right, so we start out with a discussion of Afghanistan, like I said, and this whole idea that, hey, this is something that I promised to do, and this is something that we've all wanted. You know, it makes you feel good. Finally, we're getting out of this quagmire. But already we're talking about the economy. So we're buttering up the situation here because we know it's a feel-good and a area that everybody wants, no war, and, you know, let's get out of there. And already now we're talking about the economy, right?
Even though we've turned our economy in the right direction over the past couple of years, many Americans are still hurting. And now's the time to focus on nation building here at home. Of course, there's been a real debate about where to invest and where to cut. And I'm committed to working with members of both parties to cut our deficits and debt. But we can't simply cut our way to prosperity. We need to do what's necessary to grow our economy, create good middle-class jobs, and make it possible for all Americans to pursue their dreams. That means giving our kids the best education in the world so they have the knowledge and skills to succeed in this economy. It means rebuilding our crumbling roads, railways, and runways. And it means investing in the cutting-edge research and technologies that will spur growth in the years ahead, from clean energy to advanced manufacturing.
All right, so here we are. By the way, let me get you the setup here. The video that you watch is he's in a factory or in a warehouse, and he's talking about, from a distance, we have a long shot here in the beginning, and he's talking about all the things that we really need, right? To spur jobs, to make America great, we have to do things like repair the roadways and bridges, etc. We need to beef up our educational system and make sure to invest in that. We need to make sure that we are participating in the race to get green and alternative energies, things that we've heard of 100 times, by the way, that nothing seems to be coming from it, but just keep saying it over and over and over again. And now we get this close-up, right? Almost full frame of President Obama's head, shoulders, and he's going into this discussion now about whatever it is that is going to be dynamic and is going to add to, the opportunity to benefit employment.
That's why I'm here today at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, one of America's leading research universities. Behind me is a display from a company called Red Zone Robotics. The robots they make are used to explore water and sewage pipes and find leaks and breaks before they become expensive problems. But the folks at Red Zone aren't just solving problems. They're working with unions to create new jobs operating the robots, and they're saving cities millions of dollars in infrastructure costs. This company is just one example of how advanced manufacturing can help spur job creation and economic growth across this country.
All right, let me get this straight. So this company, Red Zone, makes robotics. Robotics are utilized to make a greater level of efficiency in not only manufacturing, but all sorts of other areas of the economic spectrum. Now, when I think about robotics, I think of a couple of things. I think about efficiency, and I also think about replacement of human capital. So we're going to have these robotics built, I guess, first round by humans, by individuals, And then who knows, maybe the robotics will then create their own robotics. In other words, look at the Ford assembly plants that are run on robotics now. And I guess the only thing we could say is it's a job-killing process. All the billions of dollars are going to be saved by cities by using these robotics to look at the sewer pipes and discover problems. Who did that before? I mean, this is the most ridiculous discussion about creating jobs that I've ever heard. Now, please don't take this as a party line or a political discussion, but this is what we're dealing with this government right now that comes up with plans like this to reinvigorate our economy. That's why we are, if nothing changes, frankly, we're doomed. I mean, I don't know what has to change, whether it's going to be the head of all this or the ideas or at least the understanding that this administration has for what is actually going on. To have a discussion, to think we're stupid enough to believe that robotics will actually be the cure for long-term structural unemployment is absolutely ludicrous. In fact, I'll go one step further by saying the problem and the reason and some of the causes for the long-term structural unemployment is due to robotics, is due to technology and enhancements in the manufacturing process. It's absolutely the most upside-down argument I've ever heard.
That's why this week we launched what we're calling an advanced manufacturing partnership. It's a partnership that brings our federal government together with some of America's most brilliant minds and some of America's most innovative companies and manufacturers. Their mission is to come up with a way to get ideas from the drawing board to the manufacturing floor to the marketplace as swiftly as possible, which will help create quality jobs and make our businesses more competitive.
All right, so back to the whole idea of making our businesses more competitive means making them more cost efficient, which again means less people working. And what the president here is saying is that we are going to fund essentially a think tank to think of ways to do this. Does he believe that there isn't enough thought process that has been put into the manufacturing process already, that involving government to create efficiencies is something that actually works? I mean, here's an oxymoron for you. Government and efficiency. Those two words don't belong in the same sentence. So again, this is kind of where we're staying and where we're, it's frustrating. It's where we are living with the uncertainty about our future and with a government that clearly has no idea of what to do at this point. They're grasping at straws. They are not clear about what to do. And a lot of that comes from the fact that they don't have any real business experience. It's very simple. So I think that, you know, when we look at this, I think it's important to understand that, you know, when we listen to this, it sounds good, but we need to dig a little bit deeper into really what's going on here. Even Bernanke last week in his discussion says that he's not sure where everything is going right now. He's not sure what the outlook is. It's getting a little fuzzy. Now, I know there's a lot of people that listen that are, you know, not thrilled about the whole discussion of politics, but this is really a discussion about economics. And the economics of the situation is very clear right now. And that is that there will be further jobs lost, whether this plan goes through or not, but there will be further jobs lost as companies do what they can to create greater efficiencies, to make sure that their margins are up, especially in a time when revenues may start to cave in a little bit. All right, so let's talk about a few other things. There is a debate going on right now whether or not Greece will be able to pay their debt, or at least get a bailout to pay off some of the debt and to roll it over. And they are walking a very tight line right now because they want to make sure that there is no chance of creating a default. Not so much Greece, but Germany, France, and the peripheral countries, because their banks own a heap of debt that is sovereign debt of Greece. Now, what will happen here is that the banks will immediately have capital ratio reductions, and that's not a good thing because then they'll be downgraded, which then cost them more money to issue, you know, issue bonds and to float their debt. And it creates this gigantic liquidity problem because of the fact that the Greek bonds will no longer be available for purchase, or at least to properly assess their value on your books. Now, if that happens, there's this gigantic rotation that will occur, and you will see that there will be a lot of shunning of all of European bonds because they will be questioned whether they're going to be able to maintain their ratings. For example, Italy has recently been put on watch. The banks have been put on watch. And now Spain is coming under scrutiny, and they're having some difficulty and question of whether or not they're going to be able to keep their debt from imploding. Now, the problem with Greece is not so much Greece. We've talked about this. It's the bigger picture of what it means for the peripheral areas. It's what it means to Deutsche Bank, what it means to Banco Santander, what it means to all of the different countries that come beyond that. Already, the $110 billion strategy to reduce debt, the austerity programs that are being talked about in Greece are only for about a $16 or $17 billion, I use the word only, but only a $16 or $17 billion bailout that was due, right? We've talked about this. That is not the concern. It's whether or not the funding for the next $160 billion is going to happen. That's where all the concern is coming in. And right now, the rioting in the streets, you know what? I think they're right, because they are going to be suffering dramatically from abusive and unrestrained government spending, as well as very poor planning. We're already seeing this kind of situation in a microcosm happening throughout the United States in the municipalities. The continual union-like process of, you know, giving cost of living adjustments, whether they're deserved or not, let's say, and, you know, mandatory pay increases and promotions and all the things that go on in municipalities and governments, union types of operations, often have this, and it's really bad for business over the long haul. And what's happening right now is what happens when the tide goes down. When the tide is up in the seas, you don't really see the bottom. You don't see the dirt. You don't see the dead carcasses. You don't see any of the problems. But when that tide comes down and gets super low, a lot of things appear on the beach. You see rocks, and you may see the excess waste on the bottom. You may see things uncovered that weren't there before. And that's exactly what's happening the closer we get to the situation where Greece is going to have to either, you know, put up or shut up at this point. And speaking about shutting up, we've talked about the big mouths that the politicians have these days and their inability to keep quiet. I got to tell you something. Over the last week or so, we've heard three or four times that there has been an approval by the parliament to allow the Greece government to enter into these austerity measures that they've talked about in order to win the bailout, which has turned out continually to be false. The vote hasn't happened yet. It's under major scrutiny by opposition parties, and that's why the euro is starting to drop rather quickly. So now we really are looking at the whole area in total and what will happen if the bottom is kicked up, tide is put down, and all of a sudden they're out there for all of us to see in plain sight. Because so far they've been able to hide behind a cloak of a $1 trillion bailout by the EU and by help from the IMF. And the area is going to, pretty much this house of cards that they've built is going to fall very soon unless somebody comes up with a solution that is palatable. Now, one of the problems that we're seeing right now is that a lot of planning, a lot of discovery about what really would happen if Greece would default. How does that affect me? Well, okay, it's bad, so the stock market may go down and maybe some bond issues here and there. But, you know, they're starting to look into how much debt of the Eurozone is held within money markets right now. And there's a really big concern and talk in the SEC and in government about what are we going to do if there is a default. That's why there is so much emphasis on stopping a default from occurring. There's a real concern about what would happen if this would spread so far that even the short-term paper would come into question, and throughout Europe, the banking sector start to really decline. What would happen is that money markets would possibly be hit, and therefore we'd have to talk and consider back again like we did when the Lehman situation hit, that making sure that we have the right amount in our money markets that are protected from, you know, from the situation with the FDIC. But moreover, the money market mutual funds, which are not necessarily protected in all circumstances, what would happen there? Now, one thing that we're hearing is we're hearing a lot of discussion. For example, from PIMCO, Mohamed Al-Erian is talking about the inevitability of a default in Greece. George Soros is coming out and saying it probably would be the best thing. And there's a lot of discussion now about what's going to happen when this does happen, and would it really be something that's good by taking out some of the rotten apples, if you will, from the European area, from the zone, you know, from the EU. Take them out of the euro. Could be interesting. We'll see. But be aware that there's going to be a lot of discussion, and this is why we have talked about being very careful right now and not really stretching yourself out on the long side of things, and why we've hedged and actually looked at the dollar as a major component of some of this action. Because when we have the dollar rising, we know that it's bad for commodities, right? We saw what happened with gold and silver and oil and a variety of other commodities over the last week. And we're going to talk to Corey Rosenblum in a second. We're going to get to him about exactly the trigger points for the dollar. But this whole idea that, you know, that when we see all this discussion about the budget deficits and the debt ceiling, all, it's really bad for the dollar. A lot of people are like, oh my God, the dollar is going to disappear one day, and that's why I'm going to own gold. And you know what? At the end of the day, folks, when things get bad, everybody comes home to pop a dollar. They come to the yen, they come to the dollar. So when things really get bad, if they ever get bad, look what happens with the dollar. And realize that the diversification that you need is kind of much bigger than just gold or silver or some kind of other precious metal or oil or whatever it may be. It's or another currency for that matter. It needs to be, you know, in the dollar as well. So I wouldn't be you know, so concerned about the dollar just disappearing one day, because you know what? If the dollar goes to zero, that's the least of our worries. Now, what we're looking at right now, I want you to pay attention to, because this, I think this is really important, and some of the key areas that I think are really the ones that are making us nervous and what's making us worry about the market moving forward, because there is some tells, some hints that are out there, clues, if you will, about what's going on. For example, we talked about the U.S. dollar. We're going to talk about that more. Bonds. Even last week, when there was some rally attempts that went on, bonds were getting bid up. They were being bought. Now, why would that happen? Usually what you'd find is towards the end of the month, you would see, well, the sector that did really well over the month, maybe they'll sell out a little bit and they'll start looking to put money into the better sector, the worst sector, like the Russell really didn't do well, the NASDAQ. So you have this rotation and this reallocation and rebalancing of portfolios. But what we saw was that even though there was buying going on in the stock market, right, the Russell had a pretty good day or two last week, that bonds were still being bid up. The yen was still being bid up. And even though the dollar came down one day, it moved up pretty dramatically the next. Looking at the U.S. dollar, the price of bonds, you could look at the 10-year treasury. You could look at the yen and the euro. Those things right now are what's leading the whole market, or they're the tells of the market. You could watch those and realize that they are pretty much synchronized with what traders are doing. As money is coming back to the dollar, they're selling commodities. As money is going back into bonds, they're selling stocks. And as money's going to the yen, you have to realize with all the trouble they have there, that what's really going on is it's a safety trade. That is the classic safety trade of all safety trades, is the yen and the dollar. So even though we have this opportunity next week, and I'll tell you, particularly on Tuesday, because the day that we see the Case-Shiller numbers come out and the consumer confidence number has been an interesting day historically. For whatever reason, maybe it's because it's towards the end of the month and it's like, okay, we give in to whatever numbers are going to come out. There's been an interesting reversal from a low point higher, particularly when the market has been really bid down during the month previously. When you look back, especially at the worst times of 2008 and 2009, those Tuesdays where you had the Case-Shiller in the morning and then the 10 o'clock reading of consumer confidence from the conference board have been really what we call long tail days. Long tails on a candle is when it goes down really hard in the morning and all of a sudden it starts reversing and moves much higher and you get a rally over the next few days. That's the perfect day, that Tuesday. Again, you have to use a little bit of massaging and kind of watching. It's not absolute. But that day, what's interesting about it is that you may see that it's the day that the rebalancing start through Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Because that Friday, it's already too late. And a lot of times, the window dressing that goes on and the movement is frowned upon the day before because it's seen as just mutual funds and hedge fund managers trying to bulk up their value ahead of their fee structure payments, right? So think about that. All right, let's get to Corey because I want to talk about the dollar. I need to talk about a few things. And then I'm going to talk about silver and oil and some things because that's going to tie into the whole dollar discussion. With us now, Corey Rosenbloom, and he is the writer and the owner of Afraid to Trade, which is a great technical website. He's also the author of The Complete Trading Course. What's it called? Complete Trading Course?
That's right, it's a complete trading course.
Yeah, that's great. I love that book because it's just so clear. You know, the other thing is that Corey actually has been, you've been on the road a lot, Corey. I mean, you've been at the money shows, you've been talking over at a variety of different events. I mean, you're getting pretty popular. Are you going to be able to talk with us in the future if you get too famous?
I don't know. I'm having fun. I enjoy the technical analysis of the markets. It's a passion. Looking at the markets trading on an intraday basis, beyond that, the analysis, looking at the intermarkets is just a puzzle. You know, what's happening here, what's happening there, and I just enjoy it. So I appreciate all the interest and the attention, so I'm just happy to be doing this.
All right. Well, listen, I got a couple of things, specific things I want to talk to you about, because we know that the dollar, the U.S. dollar, you know, represented by the, we call it the Dixie, right, DXY, has been under a lot of pressure over the last few years, and a lot of that is due to a couple different things. One of it is the obvious QE process that the Fed's been doing. Also, we have this risk on trade concept the last 2 years. But trends don't always stay forever, right?
No, they don't. And in technical analysis, we use foundational principles. And the one that we use the most saliently, the most core principle, is really described the best by Martin Preen. And it's the trends, once established, have greater odds of continuity than reversing. It's also just Dow theory, really. But the quote from Martin Preen, is what technical analysis explained, is our job as investors, our job as traders, is to identify these trends at the earliest stage possible and then ride that trend, trade in the direction of that trend, or position longer term in the direction of these higher time frame trends until the weight of the evidence suggests the trend has reversed. We may be seeing that right now in the dollar index. Trends do not go on forever, but they usually show lots of signs of reversal in terms of divergences, breaking moving averages, breaking trend lines, or we have a little kickoff signal we look for in momentum. These things are happening in the dollar as we speak.
So one of the things that I find interesting about the dollar is that it is probably, let me think about this for a second, I think probably the most hated currency that I've ever seen.
That you've ever seen.
Right?
There's a lot of things that are probably...
The peso, the Mexican peso back in the 90s. Okay.
right.
One of the areas that I'm interested in is there has been such a dramatic movement to try to discredit the dollar in the favor of things like commodities. But the idea that the Fed has been there and has done what they can to really press the dollar down. I mean, what is it going to take to reverse this trend? Is it a fundamental situation, or do you think the technicals will really just blow out at some point and push traders out?
Well, I'm much more of a technician. I started as a fundamental analyst and fundamental investor, but really just had the interest and the knowledge in the technical world of the last about 10 years now. So I'm speaking from a technical standpoint, and what we're looking for, right, there's been a persistent downtrend, speaking on the charts here, from really about 2002, when the dollar was 120, the index was at that level, and then it bottomed in 2008 at $72, $71 on the index level. But then that was a primary trend move down. What we've seen since 2008 is an intermediate sideways trend, actually. We've had up rallies of significant movements from 71 to 90 in 2009, back down to 74 at the end of 2009, back up to 88, 89 in middle of 2010, and right now we're coming off the 72, 73 level. So it's really the intermediate trend, that three-year movement is actually a sideways consolidation, we would call it. And so right now we're at the bottom of that range, and so odds would favor if this movement holds, we can have a movement up into these higher levels. It's just a technical, people call it mumbo-jumbo, but that's what we're looking at in the charts. And charts can have a way to look at historical patterns to see the probabilities, at least, of the future movement. And right now that would be, as we move off the lower channel, towards higher levels, just in a simple way to describe it.
And what is the bigger picture is a structure that is in a downtrend. So you're saying this is going to be a potential uptrend within that downtrend? To what point?
Right. Well, it's kind of a good question there. The larger trend starting from 2002 was at 120 and it's taken us down in a series of, we look at trends by price. Higher highs, higher lows is an uptrend. Lower lows, lower highs is a downtrend. And that's clearly evident on the monthly charts. But starting with 2008, we've had a rally of a higher high, a higher low, a little bit of a lower high. It's a consolidation. So we would call we look at trends as a short term, intermediate term, and then long term or primary. So the primary trend is absolutely unquestionably down. There's no way to describe this dollar as an uptrend on that higher frame. Intermediate, I would call it a sideways from 2008 to present, has been a series of a higher highs and or a consolidation area. But the shorter-term trend would be those intermediate swings. So let's say the swing from 2008 to 2009, from 71 to 90, that was a short to intermediate-term rally, an uptrend. That was reversed. We had a down move, et cetera. And that's created the consolidation pattern now. So on a short-term basis, yes, we're looking for signals, especially on the daily chart, breaking of intermediate moving averages, breaking of a higher high, a higher low, and actually taking that next level out. So we're basically looking at this series of down moves on the daily chart is reversing. We just had a recent higher high into May in a 76 area, then down into June for 74 for a higher low, and now we are threatening to take out that higher high at 76.50. If that happens, that will meet the criteria of the Martin Pring and Dow Theory, old-school scholars, of a technical trend reversal, higher high, higher low, take out the higher high. That's the weight of the evidence model.
And you're saying this at 76.50 approximately?
Exactly. That's going to be the May high. So mm-hmm. as we're creeping to this level now, as we speak, we're right under that level. And anything that goes above that would officially, from that quantification standpoint, and it's lots of ways to quantify trends, and that's the easiest one I've found, just pure price. The other way is in moving averages. So we're seeing positive motion in moving averages too.
One of the things that you and I talked about, because we had a discussion earlier over the weekend about, where is that trigger? Where is the potential for, I guess as you would say, the earliest potential point that you can get an alert or at least an idea of when that trend changes? And one of the things that we've seen from a few studies that we've looked at is right under that 76 level is kind of that, things are really moving in that direction. Now, maybe confirmation of that is again above 76.50, as you say. But one of the things that you write about in your intermarket reports continually, I think it's a standard line or at least a blueprint that you put down all the time, is that higher dollar is bad for commodities and bad for stocks. And how much easier can you put that or clearly? And the reverse is true as well. And what we've seen is, I think, tell me what you think about this, but it seems like this is more so right now than we've seen in a while, because there is such a heavy weighting of short dollar, long commodity, short dollar, long stock, short dollar, long anything,
right,
that a stampede could really appear here if the dollar does break above and goes into a trend direction change.
Sure, and that's exactly what we look at. It's, we call the term positive feedback loop. And a positive feedback loop is, so the people that are quite heavily leveraged to the sell side, they're short, they're net short dollar futures or net short the currency with other pairs, whatever their position is net short the dollar or bearish the dollar. When it begins to make these theories of higher highs, higher lows, breaking trend lines, breaking moving averages, whatever the metric that a person would use for recognizing a position is wrong or the position is changing, or they're losing money, really, they have to come out, they have to exit. And that's a buy. When they cover a short, they buy. And other investors, other traders, see this trend reversal. They see this sequence of higher highs, higher lows, and they actually see that rally as a motion to get in. So it's a positive feedback loop where higher prices force short sellers to come out, to buy, and which encourages other bulls, or those that want the expect the dollar to go up. In this case, maybe call them bottom fishers. It's at the low ends, and so they're trying to play this trend reversal early. They buy, and that causes more bears to come out to exit, and then more bulls to come in. So this is the logic of a feedback loop, and it changes the dynamics, changes the positioning, and changes the psychology, really, of what's going on. You really can't be bearish when dollar's making higher highs, higher lows, and, you know, impulsing to the upside with momentum. We're seeing momentum pulses too. So the evidence is turning. So as that continues to happen, or if that continues to happen, the bears will have to exit other positions. So you're right. That can exactly cause a stampede and an impulse move to the upside.
What would be the positioning that you would take that you would say would be a reasonable position? Would it be directly in something like an ETF like UUP, which is the bullish dollar ETF? Would you look at maybe shorting other currencies in a pair, maybe FXE against the euro? I mean, what kind of, or just stay away from the currencies altogether if this analysis proves out, you know, to be a trend reversal?
Sure. Most investors, most people that are a longer-term portfolio, they're adding the dollar in terms of positions or an asset allocation. They would probably use UUP. That's probably the most common ETF. Those that can do so can trade dollar futures, DX, or the symbol at DX is your dollar futures contract. Otherwise, there are Forex contracts to short, if need be, and other ETFs as well, as you mentioned, too. So that's a position as well. And so that's probably the easiest way for most people. Otherwise, there's options, of course, calls, short puts, et cetera. But in terms of risk management, if you're expecting a trend reversal, if you position into a breakout at that zone of 76.50, the market should not break the series of lower lows. And that would be at 74 is your intermediate low. There was a stop loss to be placed at that level. And then beyond that, of course, is 73. And that's our May of 2011 low. The dollar should be making a trend reversal, definitionally. It cannot make those lows. And if that happens, one would need to exit the positions that were placed, that were bet for a bullish reversal. Anything under 74 right. is a warning. 73 is down. That this is not going to work. It's a failed reversal signal.
Mm-hmm. So would you also look to move out of things that you may have been in also if you are in let's say that you have equities or maybe gold or silver or oil, or I don't know, just, picking these ones that oftentimes have the most divergent returns compared to the dollar. Will above, let's say, 76.50 be a alarm that should go off to say, hey, if you're in dollar-sensitive items, investments that will move away when a dollar moves higher, be aware at this point and maybe consider cutting back those positions as well?
Sure. I would argue that the alarm has already taken place in terms of the equity market, oil, silver for that matter, gold, et cetera. The alarm really was on that first move up. And it's that first move from May. Go back and look at the dollar index, really, and it made a new momentum high. Mm-hmm. We call that the kickoff signal. That's an early warning signal when momentum is making a new chart high or a significant new high. When price is not, it's a very powerful signal that was discussed by Richard Wyckoff back in the 20s and 30s. So it's an early thinking technical analysis. That has happened. We're seeing similar kickoffs to the downside in some of these commodities, especially oil, stocks for that matter. And I would say what I like about technical analysis in this intermarket frame is we're having reference levels. The key level to watch in the dollar, of course, is 76.50. If you're going to be more conservative, 77. For stocks, that level is 12.50. We're having a massive support level there. It's also the March 2011 low in stocks. Should the dollar reverse its trend, and this would be at the minimum, a short-term play from 76.50 to the 2011 high at 81, that's a minimum target. Maximum target would be 87, 88, 89.
Wow.
And one can imagine what the stock market would do at that point. We're talking intermediate target. If the S&P loses 1250, expect 1200. And if under 1200, I know, of course, wants a dollar, but 81, expect 1150, 1100. It can really go much lower from there.
And what's what's interesting, Corey, is that we really don't have too many signs right now. Although this is not always important because you have to look forward. But we have no signs right now from the broad base of companies that have reported and who have restated come out with updates of their quarterlies to, you know, give their forward statements. Like Caterpillar recently came out and said, hey, you know what, we're going to make this money, and a few others did. We haven't seen too many companies come out with questionable outlooks. A few here and there, no question about that. But it's interesting to note that the stock market has been very much afraid of what's going to happen, and rightfully so, considering all the things that have gone on. And more importantly, I do question what's going to happen in next quarter. I mean, the opportunity for a major reversal, by the way, on the upside, if earnings come in solid, is going to be enormous, right? I mean, wouldn't you agree with that?
I would agree with that. But I would go beyond just the earnings in individual stocks and look at the broader picture in terms of what the economic numbers have been showing. And you've written about this as well. The surprise factor to the downside. We have our consensus numbers, and we have, say, the consumer confidence or unemployment numbers or a Philly Fed survey or Empire State survey or CPI, et cetera. We're going through all these metrics. Many of them, or at least some of them, have surprised beyond consensus, beyond the imaginable number of analysts to the downside. And that's something that's really caught my attention. And the stock market has reacted negatively to that, falling really from April, May to present June. As a result of that, multiple misses. So that's, I would say that's probably a larger factor than individual company earnings, individual companies. Some of them miss, some of them make, some of them beat expectations, some don't. But the broader picture is the thesis that we arrive with is the economy might be deteriorating at a much more rapid pace than the analysts are factoring in. And if that winds up to be true, if this is not just a soft patch, it's beginning of something more serious, the stock market would dislocate to the downside relatively quickly, I would think, if that winds up being the case.
You know, the one thing that's interesting is I read a couple of pieces this weekend on the whole idea of the massive amount of negative surprises that we've seen recently, and one of the people that I read came up with a chart that looked at when negative surprises get to this level, like the number of negative surprises, that you kind of get a peak on the downside within a reasonable amount of time. Now, I'm not trying to say I'm bullish here or bearish. That's not the point. But I thought it was really interesting that they're taking this as usual and turning this around as to looking at this as getting close to a bottom. Now, you got to admit that there has been an amazing amount of support at these levels of the S&P 500, of the Dow, and almost stubbornly so.
Agreed. But the same thing we discussed in terms of the feedback loop for the dollar, a breakthrough of this level at 76.50 or conservative 77, think what would happen to money managers, pension fund managers, your average person that follows the market more than a retail investor does when the market breaks 1250.
Mm-hmm.
What that would do would break the 200-day moving average, which is a reference for lots of funds in terms of how they define uptrends. The stock is a buy, or a market is a buy, if above this level. If under it, then it's a sell. It's a hedge, neutralize the position, or take other defensive measures, if not just sell the position totally. And with the S&P, if the S&P moves under that level, I would imagine you have a similar change in psychology, a similar fear would be the dominant game at that point. But until that happens, and that's not happened as of this phone call, or as of this podcast, so were that to happen, that would change. But otherwise, it's seen as a support level. Investors want to buy as close as possible to these levels because it gives you the best risk reward. The stop loss would go under it. And of course, a position, if it works, would have the best favorable execution.
And that's why we see all those bounces, those dramatic bounces on especially individual securities off of the 200, much greater than we've ever seen off of a 50.
Absolutely. Well, it's a level. Some people don't look at I've met other fund managers, and I was almost this way when I was starting into the investment world. We don't look at charts that much, but you will look at general trends. You know, is the price moving up or lower or higher or lower? And if you're looking at the 200-day moving average, because that's really the annual price. That's the level it's traded for a little bit less than a year. And if it's above that, that's a good thing. If it's under that, that might not be so good. So it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy where the action of a price to that level, I guess investors will buy into that, but if it fails, they'll take their stops. They'll take stop losses, or some people will initiate shorts, and it creates a change of psychology, a change of thought, a change of definitions, and arguably a change of structure, in which case, yes, that would be a negative. But until that happens, of course, that's seen as a buying opportunity.
I hear you. Hey, Corey, I appreciate all that you have to offer here. Everybody, you must visit his site, afraidtotrade.com. Pick up his book over at Amazon. We'll put links to that information on this show notes for this podcast. And, Corey, I really appreciate all that you do, and I do think that you're on the right track when it comes to this. We will see if it does do the old if-then, and if-then where that goes, and how it would move forwards. But clearly, you know, not only from the charts, but a lot of this is linked to the difficulties in the world right now and the concerning picture in Europe. One thing on the closing, I think it's very humorous that, you know, this trade to gold, silver, and other metals, precious metals, has been, you know, if the world falls down, this is a great place to be. And I find it very interesting that the heightened concern over Europe and all that has dragged these down to, you know, levels that are hitting important support points at this point.
Absolutely.
You know? All right, Corey, appreciate it. We'll talk soon, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. I wanted to also discuss some of the things that you're going to be seeing in the news over the next couple of days and then talk about silver and oil. One of the things you've seen recently has been that the IAEA has released a statement recently that there's going to be a significant amount of oil that they will release on the markets. If it's actually IEA, will release a lot of oil on the markets coordinated with the United States if oil prices continue to stay high. This effort is to break the back of the high oil prices in a manipulative measure, frankly, to also hurt the speculators, which is okay. We like that because, you know, speculators are bad. We don't like speculators. You know, that's the message we're getting, at least. And it did work very dramatically to really do a 1-2 punch as the dollar was moving up last week. And then at the same time, to push this on the market suddenly. And it created this situation where oil was moving down. Now, we entered a small position for our clients of oil on, I think, on Wednesday. Now, we're not going to hold on to this if oil keeps moving down, but it seemed to have taken a little bit too much off of the top. And even though we are seeing a significant amount of downside opportunity moving forward, there may be a little pop here, and we'll kind of do our best to take a little bit of a profit with that. But more importantly, I think when you look at the headlines about what's going to be happening with the Basel rules, where they're going to be requiring banks to have a higher level of cash, if you will, or balances, or, you know, a stopgap, whatever you want to call it, from the perspective of just understanding it, basically the biggest banks in the world, the biggest financial institutions in the world, are going to be required to have an extra 2.5% or so of money available to make sure that they are liquid enough in the worst case scenarios. Now, what's going to happen here is that immediately, in my opinion, it will slow down lending. It will create a concern with bank investors. Already we're seeing, you know, in the overnights that the banks have been getting kind of hurt throughout the week in an overnight action. Every single time we see something come on about the Basel rules. And, you know, this is going to be a continuation of a governmental, worldwide, by the way, governmental process that they just can't stay out of the markets. They just can't keep their fingers out of the markets, because they want to regulate, they want to oversee, they feel they've earned the right because they did reinvigorate the markets, and they have the right at this point because they were the ones that put all the money back to resuscitate a dying situation. So they feel like they, I think the governments feel they have a little bit of ownership with this. Does that sound at all like it makes sense? And I think that they do so in a way that is very destructive. Now, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be rules. There should be. We should make sure that we don't have a situation where the most important financial institutions don't have adequate capital in the event of some very bad times. We ought to make sure that they don't do create a situation for us that has a potentially, you know, worldwide catastrophic type of outcome if they fail. I mean, that's the bottom line. I think, frankly, that we shouldn't have allowed them to get so big in the first place, that they were so significant that they could cause this kind of reaction in bad times. But now we're seeing, the continuation of the breakdown in silver and gold and oil, all the commodity structures, because of what's happening with the dollar and the realization that, look at silver. It was a trade that was way too heavy for individuals. There are actually companies right now that are stopping some of the trading by individual investors in certain silver and gold futures. We've seen already margin requirements go up, and there is going to be a lot more pain, in my opinion, as the dollar moves, if the dollar moves, into the precious metal complex. I think it's inevitable. Now, I told you a few weeks ago, I think, or maybe even more, that, hey, silver was something that we were shorting. I wrote about it several times. Hopefully you followed along with that and utilized whether it was an option, whether it was an inverse ETF, to do what you can to get in on that, because it's actually worked out very well. The question is, what happens from here? Now, silver has actually hit some very important support points and broken through. Right now, there's a bit of an air pocket between about 34 and about 32.50 or so. Now, recently, Standard & Poor's, some of the analysts there are predicting that silver can go down to 20, which seems a little bit harsh. But I'll tell you something, that come next week, if we see a continuation of the same trend, I would bet to say that Europe is going to fall, if Europe continues to do what they're doing, I would bet to say that silver is going to fall out pretty hard. Because what's going to happen is that you're going to see a mass exit. As Corey had mentioned, there is a point that you can buy and then have a good chance of return if it stays above that point. Well, under 32, you got a real problem. Under, let's say, 32 and a half, people are going to get very antsy. Now, that's about 3% from where we are now or so. 3.5%. But what will happen is you will see a massive exit. Now, you'll usually see a swing too far to one way or the other, of course. But right now, if anything happens and the dollar keeps on moving higher and there's a flight to safety out of any instrument at all, and there's a concern about market conditions that are not conducive for commodities, I'll tell you something. Watch this one. I would definitely watch this one. In closing on this whole point, though, I realized that what happened with silver is that it was the go-to place because there was the idea that silver not only had a beneficial opportunity in manufacturing as an industrial metal of sorts, but also would have the benefit of having a backing because of the precious metal and the alternative to the dollar currency. Now, with the economies that are slowing down, you kind of blow the whole idea that it's an industrial metal that is going to have a lot of usage, or at least, you know, a continuation of a buying pattern. So all you're left with is the other side, which then gets hurt by a rising dollar. So, you know, it kind of blows the whole theory on that. All right, let's end this with the discussion I think that we were talking about just for a moment is, the rebalancing that happens. I would take a look at next week to see what the trends are going to be and what's going to happen. If you see a couple of high volume days on the upside and you see the broad-based stocks, the materials, I mean, you don't see a reversal of what we've seen recently, but you know, you see a broad-based buying pattern with very good volume. That could be a very good sign that could really blow out some shorts and then can actually do something that would be beneficial to the markets. But I got to tell you, with all the headwinds right now, that would be hard to understand. We are in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, which I've mentioned to you before for our clients. We have the global allocations, which right now have a good amount of bonds in them, which have been doing very well, actually. Actually, you should take a look at some of the bonds. I mean, it's amazing how well bonds have done recently. And then on the other side, we have the more aggressive trading, which is the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, where we are pretty much fully hedged right now as best as possible in this market condition, looking to possibly that Tuesday time frame, as I mentioned, for a quick release of those shorts and those hedges. I wanted to mention one other thing. I got a couple of emails here, and some of them I answer myself, some I do on the air. And this is one that actually I think fits right well. This is from Belinda. Hello, Belinda. And he says, "Hi, Andrew. You often talk about hedge." He says, "You're talking about hedging. Oh, hedging strategies. Hedging. How can I do this easily? Thanks for all you do, and thanks for being there for me." Yeah, that's nice, Belinda. We talked about that before, and we've mentioned different ideas. You could do things. For example, you could buy an option on the VIX, which doesn't always exactly correlate to the markets. We saw that last month in particular. This is the fear gauge out there that oftentimes is used as a way that, you know, if stocks go down, this goes up, and you could actually sell it on the other side. If you think the stocks are going up, this will go down. That's one way, but it's not a direct correlation. It doesn't always work. You could do things like inverse ETFs. Got to be careful with these because you only want to hold them for a relatively short period of time. I'll use, let's say less than a month, no question about that, for, you know, holding, unless you have a directional move, because they'll do very well in a straight directional move. But if you have choppy markets or a normal, quote unquote, normal market, you don't want to hold these too long. So you could do things like utilizing the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the Russell 2000. We like to use a spread of the S&P 500 and the Russell to hedge. We use things like TZA, which is the triple short Russell. From time to time, we move in and out of that. Because it gives us pretty good use of our money and a pretty good correlation to the Russell, three times, of course. And we see it has a lot of liquidity. And we also use SPXU, which is a triple on the S&P 500. We'll also look at things like SDS, which is the symbol. That's a double. We'll look at what else are we going to look at here? TWM, which is a double inverse on the Russell 2000. And I think the whole point here is that if you do that, or you short the SPY, SPY, or you go into the single SH, you can get good exposure on the short side. But I'll tell you something, indices don't move as much on the downside often as individual stocks. So Belinda, you need to be careful with that because you need to oftentimes get more than the amount of stocks. If you have 30% stocks, you may need, let's say, 45% or so of an index coverage to ensure that you have a perfect short, or at least as close as you can get. There's no such thing as a perfect short or perfect hedge. So hedging is a way to minimize your downside, let's say, that we look at it as a way to, you know, buffer some of that downside. Whereas if you're going directly short, it's a way to profit on the downside. So that will depend on where you're going to be, Belinda. If you want to profit from downside, which of course you do, right? But if you want to have your stocks that you believe are really good core stocks, and then at the same time, you want to hedge the position out. So utilize ETFs is probably the easiest way to do it. Be careful though. You know, you got to know which ones you're getting into, and you got to know where those are set, you know, where the setups are for those. And that would be probably the most help and the best way to do it. So thanks for your question. Any questions you have, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Of course, the show notes and the information that you need is available also at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Just click on show notes and you'll see all the different things about Corey and the past guests that we had and things of that nature. And until next week, I hope that you have a safe week. Look for that Tuesday turnaround that may be occurring. Anybody interested, great time right now. If you've kind of been long this whole time, you're like, what do I do now? Hey, you know what? We got a free virtual tour of the strategy that we call the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth. If you've been listening to this for a while and you kind of like bobbing your head and you agree with things here and there, and every once in a while you don't, you just want to throw something at your computer or your MP3 player, Well, you know what? Take a look at it. Just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, check it out, quick tour of the strategy, and if it's something that you'd like, hey, that's great. We'll help you out. You have transparency of what we do, a private client website, and all your money is in your own account, in your own name, not commingled with anybody. So check it out. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next week. I hope you have a very profitable week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.